The Cycling Podcast, powered by Super Sapiens. Energy management for committed athletes and coaches.
Hello, joining you on this fine Monday from an overcast and very autumnal feeling Berlin. On October the 3rd, in fact, it's national holiday here because it is German Unification Day, 33rd anniversary of the official reunification of Germany. My name is Daniel Freiber. I'm the host of today's episode of the Cycling Podcast. What will be a very autumnal episode, we hope, as we mainly look forward to the autumn race par excellence, the race of the falling leaves in Lombardia, the Tour of Lombardy, which will take place on Saturday. Now, I've got two exceptional guests today. Joining us from a low-altitude training camp in Tenerife, I think, more commonly known as a holiday. It's the two-time Tour de France stage winner, Giro d'Italia stage winner, Liège-Bastogne-Liège winner, two-time Vuelta a España stage winner, most importantly for the purposes of today, Giro di Lombardia winner. And as of, 10 days from now, he will be an acclaimed author. During our Vuelta coverage, he survived a biblical flood, proving himself to be the most resourceful of our podcast contributors. Just to bear that out, I learned from reading his book earlier today that he wooed his now wife, Jess, at an altitude training camp in Spain's Sierra Nevada by wowing her with his knowledge of jamón bellota, that is ham from pigs fed with acorns. He was educated at St. Francis of Assisi College, but he doesn't talk to the animals. He runs from pandas. It is Dan Martin, for the purposes of this podcast, Danilo Martino. Dan, how you doing?
The introductions are getting better, huh?
Well, they are getting longer, Dan. Let's introduce our next guest. No Larry Warbass today, so they'll be slightly more concise, I think, than in previous weeks. Joining us from Pietrasanta in Tuscany, birthplace of one of Italy's greatest ever poets, Josué Carducci, and now resident of one of Denmark's greatest poets, that is him. It's a man whose handiwork is so esoteric and refined that it's published in a newspaper called Weekend Avisen, literally Weekend Opinions, which doesn't even come out at the weekend. He is the former CSC, Sky and Green Edge PR surgeon, Svengali, Leopard Trek team manager. He hates garlic and perhaps hates Belgium because he thinks Van Helsing was a burly Flandrian ruler and not a Dutch vampire slayer. He is the cycling Dracula, who will sink his fangs into any meaty issue. It is Brian Nygaard. Brian, how are you? How are relations with Belgium?
Well, after the intro, how can I not feel shining? Yeah, I'm really well. It's a sunny day in Tuscany. We have a brief stint of late summer, which looks to expand itself onto the last races of the season. I'm happy.
And how are relations with Belgium?
There is no such thing.
There wasn't too much hate mail after your... In fact, you were quite conciliatory. You were quite diplomatic after Remco won the World Championships. I expected a 50-minute anti-Belgian rant, but we didn't get that in the end. I should ask Dan to confirm to us whether you are on holiday, in fact, in Tenerife. Dan, is that the case?
Yeah, that's the case. I mean, I think I've often said this, that I must be one of the few pro bike riders who's never been to training camp on Tay Day on Tenerife, but I've come here twice on beach holidays. So it was, I think the first in 2019, when I said I was coming to Tenerife, everybody assumed it was with a bike, and no, I just went to the beach. So, yep, that's, although I did have a slight inkling to actually bring my bike this time. It actually looks quite beautiful for riding, where that never happened during my career, which is strange.
How much cycling are you doing these days?
Depends. I mean, it's time constraints, but I try to ride 2-3 times a week. You know, I've got a new association now with Argon 18, so I'm working on that's to motivate me to ride a bike now, because I'm working with product development with them, which is kind of fun as well. So and get out on the mountain bike as well, just diversifying my life, like I said when I retired.
Well, Dan, we're coming up to the 1-year anniversary of your retirement. We'll talk about that later in the show, the fact that you retired last year at the Tour of Lombardy. In fact, today, I mentioned that you'd won Giro di Lombardia in 2014. We've got someone who won Lombardy, someone who had a house for years on Lake Como. I also used to live in Lombardy for a short period, for a few months anyway. I lived in Milan. So There's a genuine danger today of something that doesn't usually happen in the cycling podcast, and has actually known what we're talking about. So look forward to that. Brian, you're also going to regale us with your tales from the weekend at the Giro dell'Emilia. But before we get to that, before we get to the racing and the Lombardy chat, I'm going to have a short, in fact, it's not actually that short because there's a lot of news. We're going to have a news roundup. And we're going to start with your old mate, Remco Evenepoel, Brian. Newly crowned world champion was welcomed back to Belgium and specifically the Grote Markt in Brussels on Sunday. In scenes reminiscent of Eddy Merckx's reception in the same square after his first Tour de France victory in 1969. The only other times Belgian athletes have been hailed, thanked, honoured in such a manner in the same venue were after the 1986 and 2018 Football World Cups, where they were knocked out in the semi-final. Remco was due to premiere, is due to premiere his rainbow jersey in Chimay Bâche on Tuesday. Plenty of racing over the weekend with the Giro dell'Emilia. We'll talk about that, as I said. Won by Elisa Longo Borghini. That was the women's race. And Enric Mas won the men's race. He beat Tadej Pogacar. In Croatia, the Crow race, that is the Tour of Croatia, it was won in the dying meters by Matej Mohoric over Jonas Vingegaard. Remember him. By a single second, Vingegaard hadn't raced since the Tour de France, yet he won both hilly stages in Croatia ahead of the same rider, the 19-year-old Oscar Onley of Team DSM and the Scottish Borders. More about him in a short while. Also this weekend, Jumbo-Visma's development team dominated the Ronde Lizard in the Pyrenees with Archie Ryan of Ireland, your countryman Dan, taking the Queen stage, and Johannes Stauner Mittet of Norway, the GC. A few hundred kilometres further north, Brian Coquard won the Tour de Vendée, and at the same rate, Julien Simon of Total Energy wrapped up the French Cup title. Also in France, or pertaining to France, Nairo Quintana announced that he will not ride for Arkea Samsic in 2023. You may remember that just before the Vuelta, Nairo Mann announced that he had signed a 3-year contract extension. Only a few hours after that, it was reported that he had tested positive for the banned painkiller Tramadol during the Tour de France, which he finished in 6th place. Quintana will face no ban for that, but he would lose the 6th place, and hence he has lodged an appeal with the Court of Arbitration for Sport to have the sanction overturned. As to his future, he said that he'll announce his new team in due course, and it's been reported elsewhere that a French World Tour team are favourites to sign him. Don't know about you chaps, but I think a good educated guess there could be that Nairo Mann is on his way to Cofidis. Any thoughts?
They denied it, didn't they? They said they weren't going to sign him.
Have they?
I think so, yeah.
More up to speed than me, Dan. Can't see him going to Groupama somehow, or AG2R, but we shall see, we shall see.
It'd be a brave move from any team after obviously what's happening with the ongoing process. It's almost like I'd expect any contract to kind of have a stipulation that if it's proven that, yeah, he's going to have a tough time getting a new team, potentially.
Particularly a French team or an MPCC team, I would probably imagine that's one of the key reasons why Arkea are not going to honour that 3-year contract. More transfer news since our last pod. Adam Yates' signing for UAE on a 3-year deal has been confirmed, as has Lucas Purstelberger's move from Bora Hansgrohe to Bike Exchange Jayco. Also on the move is Lotto Soudal manager John Lelong, who will leave the relegation-threatened team at the end of the year. Not yet confirmed, but very much on the cards is Fernando Gaviria's move to Movistar. Going nowhere for the time being is Wout van Aert, who has extended his Jumbo-Visma contract until the end of 2026. Meanwhile, the rumour mill is very much whirring, with Ineos Grenadiers being linked with a shock move for Remco Evenepoel, the new world champion. Also, well, like van Aert, has a deal until the end of 2026, with Quickstep Alpha Vinyl in his case. Velo News reported that Dave Brailsford half-jokingly texted Patrick Lefebvre about buying Remco after his Vuelta win, although Lefebvre has now called the speculation too stupid for words, said there is a zero chance of Remco leaving for Ineos. Nevertheless, there is still the faint whiff of something in the air, with Quickstep DS Davide Bramati also having to reject reports this week that he was going to Ineos. I can also tell you, chaps, that Ineos are preparing to make a significant announcement next week, I believe a couple of days after Lombardy, and it will be the signing of an important rider. Any thoughts on that, chaps? I've heard this a couple of days ago, and two names came to mind immediately. Well, this was mid sort of Remco frenzy, and there was a lot of talk about Evenepoel, and I heard some stories last week about what happened between Remco and Patrick Lefebvre at the Vuelta. It wasn't necessarily particularly harmonious between those two at all times during the Vuelta. So I thought that that might still be alive, that hypothesis. But then also, Primoz Roglic. Remember there were rumours a few weeks ago about Roglic maybe going to Ineos. I spoke to Roglic's agent a couple of days ago, and he was quite cagey. So I don't think you can completely reject that. However, it has been reported this morning that Pauline Ferrand-Prévot, the French, well, she's a road biker and a mountain biker, but best known for her mountain biking exploits, that she might be signing for Ineos on a deal, I guess. Well, I suppose inspired by the Tom Pidcock deal at Ineos, where he's competing in all sorts of disciplines. So it may be that. It may be that. Brian, any thoughts?
Be a good time to announce my comeback now.
It could indeed.
That's a real reason why I'm in Tenerife. I'm up on Tide.
Brian, my thoughts on this?
Rog to Ineos? Rog to Ineos? Remco to Ineos?
I mean, I guess they need to fill the gap until Bernal is up to par again to be a tour contender, because they really need that, don't they? But I just don't think that Roglic will really fit the bill. I don't see him at this point in his career being a replacement for anyone like Bernal if he comes back to his former best. So I don't know. I mean, it's not like they need any more strong helpers, and let alone if Roglic would even want to sign up for being that, because that's potentially what he's going to be if he stays at Jumbo to help out Vingegaard. So it's hard to say. It's hard to say. And there was some speculation about his position and his the kind of loyalty from both sides between him and the team. But as I said, it was speculation, and it seems like they're very happy with Roglic. So, yeah, I'm a little bit mystified by all that.
I mean, I mentioned Roglic's agent, Mattia Galli, who's also Jonas Vingegaard's agent, I should add. He's told La Gazzetta dello Sport that Roglic was very happy at Jumbo-Visma. However, I messaged Mattia last week. I said there's something in the air, the rumours in the air, and they're coming from Great Britain, or they've got something to do with Great Britain. Some of it was lost in translation. It was much pithier than that, what I sent to Mattia. However, his reply was Glasgow 2023. He replied with those two words, obviously half joking, in the same way that Dave Brailsford was half joking with Patrick Lefebvre, he was also half joking about Glasgow 2023. So, you know, who knows? Maybe Roglic's ultimate destination could be the UK, Great Britain, Ineos Grenadiers. Brian, I said that you'd had a little jaunt at the weekend. You actually went to see some racing, didn't you? You went to the Giro dell'Emilia, which we mentioned in passing, the men's race won by Enric Mas, women's race by Elisa Longo Borghini. We're going to have a summary of the Giro dell'Emilia, not a rigid, regimented, strict affair that you usually give us in the 90-second roundup. But you are going to tell us how your day went. And in fact, to give it a certain air of formality, we are going to have the countdown, and we are going to call it a stage summary or a race summary time trial. So you've got 90 seconds to tell us about your day in Bologna. Off you go, Brian.
Yeah, thank you. With pleasure. I took the train from Tuscany to Reggio Emilia, the bordering part of Italy where I live. I had a wonderful day. Well, actually arrived the night before. I had a beautiful meal at a place called Caminetto de Loro. I had so much for dinner that I actually didn't need lunch by the time I did myself walk all the way up to the Santuario di San Luca. The race started in Carpi, just northwest of Bologna, and then it took a little bit of a loop down and through the Apennines before concluding with five laps on the now, I think, famous San Luca circuit in the outskirts of Bologna. And it was a beautiful race, as always. It's just one of those races that if you're a climber and you can't win anything else, you have a pretty good shot at winning the Giro d'Emilia. And such it went. UAE was taking control for a long time. It looked like Pogacar, in usual style, was going to drop everyone. That didn't happen because Enric Mas got the better of him and basically rode him out of his wheel. Pogacar finished second and Pozzovivo third. All in all, it was an interesting dynamic. I was standing next to Mauro Gianetti, the manager of Team UAE, telling him that Vingegaard had just won again in Croatia, and he looks slightly worried coming in. I guess, you know, defending champion of Giro Lombardia this weekend, Vingegaard maybe has the upper hand, if not Enric Mas, who seems to be flying at the moment. I walked all the way down. It actually turned out I walked something around 20 kilometers on Saturday, and this is the important part, 40 flights of stairs. Such is the devastating...
40 flights of stairs.
Yeah, such is the devastating climb even for the spectators of Giro d'Emilia.
I believe, isn't it the longest portico? I should know this because I wrote about it in a book. It's longest in the world or in Europe?
Yeah,
I think in the world. 666 arches, I believe, if I'm not mistaken. Brian, that was outstanding. To reward you, let's play a little bit of the sound, of the ambiance that you harvested from the Giro d'Emilia at the weekend. With your very high tech recording. Sta di fatto controllando la situazione nelle prime posizioni del gruppo, Tadej Pogacar rimane sempre vigile, sempre. That was some of the atmosphere at the Giro dell'Emilia. Dan, I'm just looking down at your record in the Giro dell'Emilia. You had a good ride there in your last season, just, well, 12 short months ago, in fact. You were fifth. Is that right?
Yeah, I went well there. I didn't know.
Sixth.
I don't know.
Sixth.
I can't remember what the result was. Fifth or sixth, yeah, something like that. Yeah, I mean, I think I was second in 2011, 2010 maybe. So it was that's way back. But yeah, second behind Robert Gesink when I really should have won. I really messed up the sprint there, but yeah, hey ho. But it's always an interesting race. I mean, it's such a different effort. Like Brian said, there's no race like it on the calendar, and it's such a specific effort that, yeah, guys, it comes out with a very strong winner, a very worthy winner, but also a different winner to what we usually see. And obviously, yeah, it's Enric Mas's first ever one-day race victory, I believe, and he just showed he had that he had the legs on the last climb. But I think the thing with Pogacar is, if the race had been another five laps, he probably just would have done the same time up the climb another five times. You know, he just has that endurance that the other riders don't have, which I think why he's still be the man to beat in Lombardia. But he's although obviously as well, Pogacar's performance in Emilia was much better than it was last year.
Mm.
So I think that's the signs are quite ominous.
Yeah, and he doesn't love these exceptionally steep short climbs, does he? We've seen that at Flèche Wallonne over the last couple of years. And the Madonna di San Luca is similar in some respects to Flèche Wallonne. But we'll talk a bit more about Pogacar in the second part. Guys, I mentioned some of the racing that happened at the weekend. We talked about Vingegaard, and Brian, you said that Pogacar seemed slightly put out when he was told about Vingegaard winning in Croatia. In our roundup, I said that the rider who had ridden him closest in those two hilly days in Croatia was a young Scot called Oscar Onley, just 19 years of age. He rides for Team DSM. And today I caught up with him about the fantastic week he had in Croatia. First of all, what a fantastic week. I mean, did you see that coming at all?
Yeah, thanks. No, not really. I think... Yeah, when I first looked at the parkour for this race, I thought it wasn't going to be hard enough for me. I felt really good in training in the last couple of races, but I would have liked a bit of a harder parkour in the end. But yeah, I think I showed myself quite well this week on the stages that suited me better.
And was it the team's plan for you to be kind of protected on those particular stages, Oscar?
Yeah, so we had myself and Chris going for GC, and yeah, it was kind of, we both did it in Britain as well, the Tour of Britain, so we knew each other quite well from
that
race.
Hamilton,
as well.
Isn't it?
Yeah, Chris Hamilton, yeah.
Yeah.
And then coming into the third day, it on paper it suited me better, the final climb. I think I'm a bit punchier than Chris, and so for that day, it was all in for me in the final. And then, yeah, Chris just staying up there for the GC as well.
And, I mean, obviously, the thing that's got a lot of attention is who you were riding, who you're sprinting against, really, Vingegaard. Yeah, just talk to me. Well, talk to me a bit about the first one. I mean, some of the roads in Croatia, based on what I saw, particularly, I mean, the circuit yesterday, wasn't it? But then also that finish itself. I looked it up. I think there are 30,000 kilometers of proper roads in Croatia, and the race seemed to avoid quite a lot of them. It was on gravel, and we see some riders struggle just kind of technically on gravel. It suits some, it doesn't suit others. But yeah, tell me about that climb and how you're feeling, and well, how much of a surprise it was to find yourself next to Jonas Vingegaard.
Yes, so the beginning of the climb was on gravel, but at that point it wasn't too steep, and we were all kind of together. So it was okay. It was only the last, I don't know, maybe 300 meters that were on kind of like a concrete road you'd get in one of those crazy steep Spanish climbs, exactly, in the Vuelta, yeah, or something. And yeah, that's where the climb really started. And so yeah, coming into the climb, we tried to be in as close to the front as possible. And yeah, I think I was in the top three going into the climb. And then I just tried to hold that position. Yeah, looking back, actually, I could have played it a bit smarter. Now that I know that I had the legs to win, then yeah, I could have kind of sat in the wheels a bit more. But at the time, I was just kind of riding my own race and not really thinking about the others.
And Oscar, this year you've had good results on, well, some really big climbs, you know, Mortirolo and Falniera and in the under 23 Giro. And then you won in Cervinia, basically under the Matterhorn, isn't it, in the Val d'Aosta. And yeah, that was from a break. But the what we saw in Croatia, is that a fairly good snapshot of what your best ability is at the moment, would you say?
To be honest, before this race, I would have said no. I think I prefer the longer climbs, maybe not the really long climbs, but upwards of 10 minutes, 10 to 30 minutes, I would say is kind of the perfect length for me. But yeah, also this week, I felt really good on the shorter climbs. But I think going forward, then, yeah, I want to focus more on the longer climbs for the GC, yeah, to try and become more of a GC rider.
This is your second year at DSM, isn't it? If we go back in time, just to fill in a few biographical details. So you grew up in Kelso, a place in Scotland, the Scottish borders. I think it's more known for horse racing, isn't it, than bike racing?
Yeah, there's a race course in Kelso, and I think it's quite popular there actually.
But you grew up, well, watching bike races. At a certain point, you started to watch bike races because they were starting outside of your outside the front door of your house. Is that right?
Yeah. So my mum would always watch the tour on telly every year, and so I kind of followed that each year. And then when I think I was 10, old enough to do the local time trials with the club, which started 200 meters outside my house, and I went past my house. So yeah, I started there, and then it kind of progressed to like more youth races in Scotland and then Britain, and then as a junior, then I started to go abroad more.
Did you have any role models, any sort of idols, heroes back then, Oscar? You're going to say something that's going to make me sound really old now. I know you're going to say someone like, I don't know, Remco Evenepoel.
No, I think the first person I looked up was Andy Schleck, actually.
Okay.
I think that they're my earliest memories of him and Contador in the Tour in the white and yellow jersey.
Yeah.
Just constantly attacking each other.
So that's 2010. Think, yeah, that's okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
That just about checks out.
That's yeah, they're my first memories of the Tour.
And Oscar, just looking ahead now, I mean, obviously this opens up some horizons for you, or certainly probably opens your eyes as to where you currently kind of sit alongside World Tour pros. I mean, tell me what is the plan? What plan has been sketched out for you either by the team, or what plan have you got in your own mind for the next year or so?
Yeah, I think we'll still be sticking to the initial plan of another year in the development team. I think it can be really beneficial for me to learn how to win the races. I think this year I showed I was strong enough to be at the front, and now next year I can learn more in different situations, how to win the races. And then, yeah, hopefully from there on, I can make the step up to the World Tour. And then I hope I'm already at a higher level and I can start competing for wins straight away in pro races, which would be nice.
And who knows, beating Jonas Vingegaard in the Tour de France. Did he say anything to you after either of those two stages?
Yeah, it was really nice. He was talking to me after both stages and saying how strong I was and that he was impressed. And yeah, it was nice to get to know him a little bit this week.
The Cycling Podcast, powered by Super Sapiens. Energy management for committed athletes and coaches. And now you can wear the Super Sapiens Energy Band, the first and only wearable that can display real-time glucose data directly from Abbott's LibreSense Glucose Sport Biosensor. The Super Sapiens Energy Band is available at supersapiens.com for €159.
Thank you very much to Super Sapiens, our title sponsors. You may well remember an athlete called Jack Thompson, the ultra-endurance cyclist who featured in an early episode of Explore and more recently was a guest on Mitch Docker's Life in the Peloton when we were working with Mitch on that show. Well, Jack is a Super Sapiens athlete and ambassador. He's talked openly about falling in love with cycling after coming out of drug rehab, and over the years he set himself some pretty incredible challenges. And this year's goal is to climb 1 million vertical metres in elevation. So he's really giving Pavel Sivakov a run for his money in the bid to ride into outer space. He's been averaging 20,000 metres of climbing a week, including at least one Everesting ride of 8,848 metres. To find out more about Everesting, we made a show for Explore about that a couple of years ago. Anyway, Jack's doing all of this to raise €1 million for three mental health charities that are causes close to his heart. Jack's dad has type 1 diabetes, and so when he was growing up, Jack got an insight into the impact of glucose levels on his dad's health. And as an athlete, he's now using Super Sapiens to fuel most effectively for this incredible climbing challenge. This week, Jack is taking over the Super Sapiens Instagram stories ahead of World Mental Health Day on October the 10th. So check it out at Super Sapiens Inc. on Instagram. And best of luck to Jack as he continues to climb and, overtake Pavel Sivakov as they head out into the stratosphere. To find out more about Super Sapiens itself, go to supersapiens.com. Before I hand back to Daniel, thank you very much for the incredible response to the MAP Cycling Podcast jersey and accessories. They've been shifting like the proverbial hotcakes. Some regions sold out very, very quickly of all the jerseys and also some of the accessories. And we've been blown away by the unprecedented response and the feedback. It was a bit too cold for me to wear the short sleeve jersey in Scotland last week, but I was out this morning in the autumnal sunshine in my jersey, and very nice it was too. A really lovely collection that MAP have put together for us. Check out map.cc, that's MAAP.cc, to see what's available in your region. As I say, some items have completely sold out in some regions. Lots of caps available in all regions, I gather, and in the UK there's good availability of most of the accessories too. Or at least there was when I got my last update from MAP HQ. If you haven't managed to get your hands on a jersey yet, never fear, because MAP are doing a new run of the men's and women's jerseys, water bottles and socks, and so the whole collection will be available again around mid-November in time for Christmas shopping. If you want to make sure you don't miss out again, go to map.cc, find the Cycling Podcast collection and click notify me to get a heads up the minute that the sold out items are restocked.
Did a really good job, but in the end, Enrique was much stronger in the final climb, and I'm happy with the result. I must admit that he was better, and it was a really great race, really nice finish, and I'm happy with the shape.
And what does it say about your shape after two trips to Australia and back?
Yeah, it's actually, compared to last year, it's much, much better in this race, so I'm happy that I improved in this in particular race, and I'm looking forward for Wednesday and next Saturday.
Yeah, I guess it must be a big goal, Lombardy, you will pass winner. Is it in your head?
Yeah, it's Lombardy's last year I won, but it was different course. And this year we go with the same mentality there for the final race of the season.
Well, chaps, that was Tadej Pogacar after finishing second behind Enric Mas in the Giro dell'Emilia. We alluded to this, obviously, in the first part. Well, Brian, in fact, gave us a very forensic account of the Giro dell'Emilia. And, well, Dan, you said that he's obviously going better than last year. Pogacar echoed those sentiments. But, well, Brian, let's start with you. You were on the ground looking ahead to the Giro di Lombardia or Lombardia at the weekend. What have we learned that will be important come the weekend?
I think that it was quite interesting what Dan said about, you know, looking back at Pogacar last year, where he was, you know, phenomenal in Lombardia and not so much in Emilia. I think it will be interesting to see, because this, you know, next weekend will be the big showdown potentially between Pogacar and Vingegaard. Since the tour, you know, they haven't raced against each other since then. Vingegaard famously skipped the Worlds and hasn't really done anything until he had those 1,000 kilometers of racing in Croatia. Enric Mas looks extremely convincing. Whether that will be enough to drop everyone on the parcours that we have this year in Lombardy, I doubt, and I still see both Vingegaard and Pogacar as potentially bigger favorites than him. A lot of riders I spoke to in the past when I was, you know, working for teams, they always said that Lombardy, you really have to be extremely motivated because it's so hard and it's the end of the year. You kind of have to make it a big goal in itself. And there are, you know, other than, you know, Nibali and Valverde finishing their cycling careers in it, I think we have to look to basically the best climbers in the world who are still in good enough shape to win a monument. And there aren't really that many of those. It's very, very rare that it's... it's an outsider's race. I don't see that happening. So I would still say that like I said, Vingegaard, Pogacar being the favorites. After what I've seen, I didn't see Vingegaard other than on TV. And I'll admit too that even if Pogacar did seem a little bit off the boil on the San Luca, he could still win Lombardy for the second year in a row.
I think we need to be careful too, though, because it's a very different course to what we've seen the last few years at Lombardia. And it's not a pure climber's course. And I think that's where maybe last year's course would have suited Enric Mas more, although you still had that technical descent and the runs to Bergamo. This year is very much a punchy, repetitive course, quite similar to Liège-Bastogne-Liège this year, I'd say. Which Triviglio is the longest, hardest climb, and it's only 10, 11 minutes. It's a very... You don't have that big Muro de Solmano to really destroy the race like we've seen in previous editions.
There's a long flat-ish section between the Berbeno and the Gisallo being the climb, you know, the iconic climb that's always featured in the Lombardia when it's in any format really. But I think that this year Siviglio is the final climb, but it's still with 250k in kilometers of racing, and you know it's I think it's 9-10% average, and then they've added an extra loop over the San Fermo della Battaglia, which is a bit of a kicker. It's not a hard climb, but it's a kicker climb. It was where, I think it's where Bettini actually put in the winning attack when he won the last time. So it's a punchier course, I guess, than when it finishes in Bergamo slightly. I still think it's the climber's course, and I still think the strongest guy will come out winning on the Como finish. We'll see.
Let's talk a little bit about the course, chaps. It has moved around quite a bit over the years. Well, it's always moved around, really, the Giro di Lombardia course. And we're back to a Bergamo-Como format. It's last year was Como to Bergamo for a few years. I think 4 years in a row it was Bergamo to Como. And this is the way it's gone, basically, for the last decade. It's either started in Como or finished in Como, either started in Bergamo or finished in Bergamo. Just visually, chaps, I'm going to throw the cat in amongst the pigeons here. I prefer the Bergamo finish because I just think it's more beautiful. The climb to Bergamo Alta over the cobblestones is quite iconic, I think. And it's a beautiful day in Bergamo. These Italian one-day races, it's the same applies in Milan-San Remo. The ambience, the way that the atmosphere sort of, well, it,
it grows and it intensifies and it builds to a conclusion throughout the day. I feel that it does that in Bergamo more than it does in Como. I don't know why in Como the finish line sometimes feels as though it's really, well, it is out of the main city, and Como is on the side of the lake. I know, but this is anti-Nygaard propaganda, basically.
Yeah, I found a home by the shores of Lake Como because of the old parkour, albeit they were racing on the other side, but still with this finish. I think, you know, when you compare the beautiful shores of Lake Como to Bergamo, which apart from Bergamo Alto, I'll give you that, is a nice little spot. It's got nothing on the Como finish, you know. And it's the majestic views of the lake, the iconic climbs. You know, you have the looming curves on the way up to the top of the Gisalo. You have the lakeside finish with the final climbs. I mean, what more do you want in a beautiful bike race?
Also, I think with the Bergamo finish as well, there's, you're going to lose this, Dan, because you've got you've got two against one, I think, because I'm in agreement with Brian. I'm not sure if you probably saw the Bergamo Alto down into the city. Yeah, it's beautiful, but from 25k to go until the bottom of Bergamo Alto, the race is basically held on a motorway.
Exactly.
And it's incredibly boring, and it's just like, it's nondescript. It could, the year that I won in 2014, there was 50 or 60 riders, I think, hit the bottom of Bergamo Alto, and it was the closest. That's where I think Lombardia, you say it's a climber's race and everything, and it came very close to being almost effectively a bunch sprint. I mean, we were, 11, 12 guys going to the line, and I think the nature that Lombardia needs, the beauty of the race, this amazing region that the race is held in Lombardia, it deserves to be held in a stunning location. Although, obviously, more often than not, we don't get to see any of the scenery because of the rain and the clouds and the mist around the lake. Yeah. But I'm not sure what the case will be this year, what the forecast is. But
it's brilliant. Hopefully, it'll be great weather then.
Right, it'd be beautiful. It was going to be a beautiful day in Como, and also I'm sure the coffee and food is great in Bergamo, but there is also some fantastic ice cream shops in Como. So
that's a
slightly barbed comment from Dan Martin. He's already anticipating what is what, or he can see through the veil, and he's sensed a hidden agenda behind my preference for Bergamo. And he's right, because I was mainly thinking about the polenta that you get up on the in Bergamo Alta. No, but there's a breathlessness to the Bergamo finish which I like. I must say, those last 10 or 15 minutes of the race, in a similar fashion to Milan-San Remo, you don't really get. I don't really remember that many occasions when you felt that with the Como finish, the San Fermo della Battaglia. It's tended to be the guy who has been the strongest on the climbs throughout the day has tended to emerge finally in that last battle on San Fermo della Battaglia.
Don't you remember when Thibaut Pinot dropped Nibali on the Civiglio and then bombed it to the, you know, down the descent and then the San Fermo? Or when Fuglsang won, dropping... I think it was the Jumbo-Visma rider to the win. You know, Bettini winning, you know, in the memory of his dead brother just a week after he won the Worlds. All those things belong to the Como finish.
Anyway, I'm sensing that I'm losing this argument, so I'm going to move it on. We talked about Mass and his performance in Giro dell'Emilia the weekend, where he showed that he was the strongest rider in the race. Dan, you don't think that this is necessarily a climber's route? Will it be hard for someone like him, even with the help of a Valverde who, you know, we saw last week in the Coppa Agostoni, he's riding really well. He's going to be a great ally in what's going to be his last race. But do you think it's difficult? It's going to be really difficult for someone like Mass to break everyone else's resistance on San Fermo della Battaglia?
I think Lombardia, especially this course, is very much about positioning. And although Enric Mass will have a full team committed to him, I have a feeling that also Valverde will want to have a good showing on his last race. And he's probably more suited to this type of race because of the distance, the endurance, and also just the simple bike handling on the downhills. At Lombardia, you need to be able to descend as well as you go up the hills. And it's not Enric's strongest point. You've seen him many times in the Vuelta, kind of struggling a little bit on the downhills. And yes, I do think he's going to be one of the strongest guys on Civiglia, but it's a very technical circuit, that final finishing loop in Como this year. And also San Fermo de Battaglia, it's not it's not the steepest climb. It's just a climb that looks really difficult after 250 kilometers. Whereas the first time up, it's going to be all about positioning, especially the two hairpins in the bottom. It's really going to string out the race. The group will be lined out. And if you're not in the first 10, 20 riders on San Fermo the first time up, it's going to be really difficult to move up, especially with the downhill. And then it goes straight into Cheviglio. So if you lose any, it's going to be a really tense final. Perhaps what you were missing before from Como, from the Como finish. But yeah, it's, I don't see a way that Enric can get to the finish line solo. And that's the only way he can win, because I think there's a lot of stronger sprinters who can climb just as well.
It's going to be a good test of his descending, because we all know that at the Tour de France, he had real problems with that. And then went away after the Tour de France, and he talks in quite vague terms at the Vuelta about all the help that he'd got. Some of the help was from some real sort of specialists on, I think there was at least one descending specialist was enlisted by Movistar to help him. And it obviously worked, because at the Vuelta, his descending was pretty much on point. He didn't lose any significant time on the descents. But as you say, Dan, it will be a big test. And this is also a guy who's not really got a great record in one-day races. And he hasn't got certainly the pedigree of Pogacar or Valverde or some of the other guys that we expect to be in the mix at the weekend. And Brian, your fellow Dane, Jonas Vingegaard, coming off this, well, convincing performance, pretty emphatic performance in Croatia, although he didn't win the GC. I mean, as preparation for Lombardy, any thoughts on a stage race like that being the ideal way to get ready for Lombardy, or not the ideal way?
Well, Dan is probably the better expert on this, but I think depending on what he's done before, it will be the real test of whether his preparation is good. He's apparently spent a month in Spain before Croatia, which I think is good for him considering the weather in Denmark. But, you know, he will have to, the climbing volume will have to come from training and definitely not from Tour Croatia, even if there were two sort of difficult finishes, but not in the same way that Emilia would be, or even Agostini and the other one-day races in Italy. So, and then there's also the open question, is he still able to be competitive after 250 kilometers? So then you have one thing, you have his recuperation, his training. Does he have good enough shape to race with that kind of volume? And or could his freshness potentially be in his favor? Was it freshness that he lacked, or just the style of racing he didn't like, Pogacar? I think those are all the open questions for this edition of Lombardy. I think even if his palmarès doesn't really show anything impressive for one-day races, I think if the race is hard enough and he is in his or close to being in top shape, I think I would still consider him a rather big favorite.
Has he got any chance against Pogacar in the sprint?
None such. He's fast for a climber, but on a flat, you know, we saw for instance on the Super Planche de Bayfi, when those like little aggressive kicks to the line, Pogacar in top shape is better. But I think in a flat sprint, we also saw that when the way Pogacar won Liège, for instance. He can do a proper sprint after a hard race. So can Vingegaard, but I don't think I can't build a convincing case for him beating Pogacar on the line if Pogacar is good and fresh.
Also, I think as well, with the, it's important to have that distance in your legs. And Pogacar has now done Quebec Montreal, which were over 200 kilometers. He's done the World Championships, which was what, 267. He's got that distance, that race distance in his legs, whereas going to do a Tour of Croatia, okay, they had a few stages over 200 kilometers, which were mainly bunch sprint stages, and they just rode along like pretty easy all day. So, yeah, I'm not expecting Vingo to have that depth of endurance in his legs. He might have the condition, but also I think last year's course massively suited him a lot better than at least this year's course. And it's a dynamic race this year. You need to know the course. And having raced over those roads, it's super important to be able to know where you're going, especially the Cheviglio descent over the top of the climb into the descent. If you've raced on those roads before, it's a massive advantage. And it's a final it's new, but it isn't. And it's the same roads as have traditionally been used on the Como finish. And anybody that's done them before going back to Pogacar as well, what makes him so difficult to beat is how do you beat him? I think he's got probably the strongest team in the race, I want to say, with the showing that they put in at Emilia. And I don't think he beat Wout van Aert in a sprint. I think he's, after a very, very hard race and a flat sprint, he's very, very difficult to beat. So I don't, and he can descend well as well, and he's definitely the standout favourite, but there's always surprises to be had. And with modern-day racing, I think we can definitely expect a lot of attacks on Gisala this year, just to try and mix up the race.
I think also he, you know, last year he decided to drop everyone quite early. He doesn't actually have to do that with the way the parkour is this year, in my opinion, even if the Muro di Sormano is not there. The race will sort out the selection depending on what kind of breakaway goes, if something significant goes earlier. And there'll be enough riders wanting to make it difficult, including Movistar for either Valverde or Mas. So I think he has a pretty good chance of either making the selection himself or letting the parkour make the selection. And if they come to the line after the last time of San Fermo in a 5-8-man group, which I doubt, even if it's still 5-4 riders, I still think he's the strongest man in that type of sprint. I agree with you, Dan.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
The Giro di Lombardia's route runs along the languid deep lakes of northern Italy. It is held at the beginning of October in the slightly damp autumn atmosphere and under the pale bronze autumn light. And at first, I believed it was the gentle race of the falling leaves, its nickname suggests. An end-of-the-year classic. That was until I saw the mattresses hastily placed against the rock faces on the exit of the corners on the off chance that a rider would make a mistake. Dan Martin, recognised that? Not the mattresses, and although you probably recognise those as well, but that piece of writing?
That's an excerpt from my book that's about to be released next week, actually, the 13th of October.
It's about to drop. Yeah. It's about to drop any second, isn't it, Dan? There are probably bootleg copies already on the internet, but it is it is coming out officially on 13th of October.
Chased by Pandas.
Quite extensively about... Yes, Chased by Pandas. There's a subtitle, isn't there? The Mysterious Life of... Go on, you tell us.
You know what? I don't even remember. The Mysterious Life of a Racing Cyclist or the Behind the Cycling World or something like that, anyway. That's very poor form of me not remembering.
But it's a very good book because I've been reading it. I've been tucking into it this morning. Didn't have long, but I've already devoured at least 100 pages or so. And excellent it is too, Dan. And there's a lot in there about Giro di Lombardia because it's a race that in some ways characterised your career. I mean, you had in 2009, you had a big ride there. It was it your first appearance in Lombardia where you attacked on the Gisallo, and I think you were the first over the Gisallo.
It's actually my second. I did the race in 2008, but I was empty from a Neopro season when I did a hell of a lot of racing, especially across August and September. And I think that year I actually backed up. I did Tour of Denmark, Tour of Portugal, Tour of Ireland, Tour of Britain back to back, and it was a bit too much for a Neopro. I think 36 days racing in 7 weeks or in 8 weeks or something like that, something ridiculous. But it was all in the aid of getting stronger. And but 2009 was my first good performance, first finishing performance, and that's where the mattresses came in. Whereas to put a bit of colour behind that, the race used to go over the Gisallo. And then descend towards Como, and then we would climb a different way up to Civiglio, and then we would descend the side that the race now comes up into Como, and then go straight to San Fermo and to use the same finish that the race is using this year. So, but the descent is so steep, the couple of switchbacks at the bottom on the way down, they used to put these mattresses, and I think there's these famous images of Paolo Bertini, who we all remember, like almost bouncing off the mattresses to take the corners properly.
Well, we'll get to Brian Nygaard, another man who's bounced off a few mattresses in the Como region in a minute, Dan. But just tell us, Dan, take us to a typical week before the Giro Lombardia, or a successful week before Lombardia. You talked a minute ago, or in the second part, about how important it is, or it was, to know the route. I mean, would you do recons? Was there a hotel where your team always used to stay? I mean, I guess because the races moved around a bit, perhaps not. But tell us about the week. What was the ideal week for you before Lombardia?
I mean, I always used to Lombardia because it was such a great week's racing. We used to have a really good classics crew. We'd spend the week in the hotel. We'd generally go from Emilia and then maybe Bighelli, taking another Italian one-day race, move on to Piemonte, and then Lombardia on the Saturday. And traditionally, it was quite a little bit controversial at the time, being such a young rider doing this, but I would, because Piemonte was normally on the Thursday ahead of Lombardia on the Saturday, I would really put all my focus on Lombardia, and I would stop Piemonte at the feed zone after about 70 to 100 kilometres, just simply using it as a way to open my legs up before the race on Saturday, and that seemed to work every year. And it was just a recon. I generally tried to do it earlier in the season. Depends if the course changed. It used to have a pretty consistent run of routes. Back then we changed from, I did the Como recon with, with Dario Limpi, who lived close to Como in 2009, in the summer, I believe it was, in maybe around August time. And managed to take in the course then. But every year, it's one of those things that when you look back, and it's maybe something we can look into more this year, with the obviously arrival of, we've talked about Enric Mas being so strong. Every year that I was very good at Lombardia, I had just come out of the Vuelta. And I think it shows, it does come down to that whole, it's not necessarily motivation, but it's just impossible to replicate the load that a Grand Tour gives you at this point in the season. And if you've done the Tour de France, you generally, by this point in the year, you're starting to be tired, and you're mentally, it's difficult, it's challenging to really put in the same training load as a Grand Tour. Whereas every year I did the Vuelta, I kind of arrived at, you don't really need to train before Lombardia, and it means you can just arrive in this top condition without really mentally straining yourself, and then you can put this, you're mentally fresh to really be able to challenge what it's a demanding race. It requires concentration, and that's what where a lot of guys fall back, especially with the often poor weather, or even avoiding the fallen leaves, which make the race actually quite treacherous. You know, even when the weather is good, you still have this humidity in Lombardia that makes the road quite slippery, and especially on these technical downhills, you always need to be fighting for position, you need to be in the front and remain 100% concentrated. So, yeah, it's a race that you, unlike the other classics, it's difficult to learn because they keep changing the course. But yeah, recon is important, but it's not important as the other races, as the other races, as the other big classics. But it's still good to know where you're going. And obviously, yeah, but it is a race that if you have the legs, you can be in front.
It's funny, Dan, you talk about the positioning and it being stressful, and you won two monuments. You also won Liège-Bastogne-Liège. Of the two, Liège is the one that I associate with, you know, fight for position, half of a lot of the teams being taken up by, you know, big rulers, and there being a big sort of dose, a big element of what is sort of more typical, more quintessential Belgian classic-style racing, whereas Lombardy, when I think of Lombardy, mind's eye sort of races to, well, something that looks a bit more like a Grand Tour mountain stage. You know, partly we read out that passage from your book, the sort of languid, the mist that hangs over the lakes and this, you know, the beautiful colours and stuff. And I guess it feels a little bit calmer, a little bit more serene, but you're telling us that it's not like that at all.
I think as well that comes down to the course changes. I think since 2014, 2015 maybe, RCS have really tried to make the race harder and harder. And I remember that, I think it was 2016, it was over 5,000 meters climbing or something ridiculous. And same as last year. Last year, there was real mountains in the race. It wasn't the typical Lombardia that we used to see. Like Paolo Bettini wouldn't have won last year's Lombardia, and he was renowned as being the perennial favorite every year, right? And Philippe Gilbert the same. Yeah. It was generally a classics riders race, a hilly classics riders race, where you saw, guys like Gilbert, Paolo Bettini, Vinokourov. It was a Grand Tour riders race, but also you needed to have a multifaceted approach to the, you need to be able to sprint, descend, be a rouleur as well. So it was an all-rounders race rather than a pure climbers race that it's now tended to become the last few years, as these really long climbs starting with the Somano, but then it's got even more extreme in the last few years.
I think the interesting change this year compared to the, say, standard, if you can even call it, that arrived in Como is that they've scrapped the Muro di Sormano, which we've all known, this really narrow, ridiculously steep road from the lake all the up. And then the really difficult descent, the one where Remco Evenepoel almost finished his career before it started. So that's all gone now. So that means that the relevance of the Madonna del Gisallo, you know, this very famous climb with the chapel and one of the holiest places in cycling, is a lot more central now. But still, it's some 60 kilometers from the finish. But then the finish as such, the last couple of climbs, with Civillo being the hardest one, is a lot more compact. So I think it'll be a different dynamic with the Muro di Somano and that difficult descent from it down towards back towards the lake. It's going to change the dynamics a little bit, and I'll be interested to see in what tactical approach the different teams will use. I think that the first big real attack will be on the Gisallo, and that could take away the winning group already.
Yeah, you mentioned, or Dan mentioned, Paolo Bettini there. I mean, he was a rider who, at least one of the occasions when he won Lombardy, he made his decisive move on the Gisallo. But it's a bit of a paradox. It's the most iconic climb in Lombardy and in Lombardy's history, yet quite rarely has it been decisive, because it's difficult. It's difficult to sort of shoehorn it in, whether you finish in Bergamo or Como. It's difficult to put it close to the finish, isn't it?
And it's only really hard at the bottom. It's sort of the first 4K are really hard, but then there's actually descent, and then it rises a little bit up towards the bell tower. So it's not an easy platform for attacking.
It's also got that long, big road downhill afterwards towards Como, and then I think any group that gets away there is going to have a difficult time getting to the finish, especially this year, because you're going to have the run all the way down into Como to do the San Fermo. I mean, that's the next climb on the course. And there's going to be a huge fight for position going to San Fermo, because that's really going to be the crucial point in the race. I don't expect any attacks on San Fermo, but it's such a small road and narrow and twisting. And then you've got the fast descent directly into the bottom of Civiglio, which is that's the hardest, most that's where the race winning move potentially will happen. It's a really, really tough climb, but it's
I think the winner will come from the first ride on top of Civiglio, even if they still have the San Fermo afterwards. If it pans out the way I think or hope it will be a beautiful race that way. But I mean, Civiglio is one of the hardest climbs in any classic, and it's actually not that short.
It's 12 minutes, I think, normally. So yeah, I think it's 4 kilometers, 11% average, which is, yeah, as you say, brutal.
Dan, we've talked about your book, and I said that there are quite lengthy passages in there dedicated to Lombardy. Just thinking about that 2014 win, when you revisited that in the process of writing the book, well, what feelings did that kind of conjure up, and what feelings does it always conjure up when you think about that day, and what are the sort of images that come most readily to your mind?
I think, ironically, it was probably the course that suited me the least of all the times that I rode Lombardy, and it was the race that I had a plan on how to win the race, and it really didn't work out, which is, it shows how, I think, to be a classics rider, you really need to be dynamic and kind of let the race open up and tactically be aware, because it's, I planned to attack on the last climb, obviously, but there were so many spectators on the side of the road that we were basically in single file. And I think Philippe Gilbert was second or third in the group, so he had the position to be able to launch over the top, but once the road widened up, but it, it was just an opportunity that I had a plan to be first into the last corner, and my attack was more, it was all in to be first into the last corner, whether the guys were on my wheel or not, and in the end they weren't, and I managed to obviously get it across the finish line. But it was probably the easiest edition of Lombardia that I rode, simply because of the course. It didn't have, I mean, even the penultimate climb, which was, I think, 30, 40, maybe even 50 kilometers to go, wasn't even that hard, and that's what led to a sizable group coming into Bergamo Alto for the final. So it was the big climbs were really early in the race, and it was a hard race as always. I think still over 3,000 meters climbing.
And you accelerated. You went away from.
Yeah, I just found that hole. It was using the elastic. We sprinted out of the last corner, or the penultimate corner. We sprinted out of it as you always do, and with the elastic of taking the corner, and I was in last position. And I just kept sprinting when the other guys kind of eased off the pedals kind of to start the cat and mouse game. I just kept sprinting and carried that momentum past everybody. And I think played off, obviously, the fact that everybody was kind of looking at the better sprinters in the group and expecting them to chase. And it was just at that point, all you need is that moment's hesitation to be able to get enough of a gap. And especially once I knew that with the last corner with, I think, 200 meters to go, 250 meters to go, you needed to be first or second into the last corner anyway. So it was a case of I didn't even look behind. If they were on my wheel, I still had a chance of being on the podium, and that was really the aim that day. And to obviously, I didn't look around until about 50 meters before the finish line.
I said that Brian Nygaard used to live in Como. I forgot that he also left his grubby fingerprints over an edition of Il Lombardia in 2011. Am I right, Brian? A rider yeah. you recruited for a team that you started. One in very surprising, also in very surprising fashion, because no one had tipped him. He was called Oliver Zaug. He was Swiss, and he was a former chimney sweep. And I remember I was there that day. The finish was in Lecco, and well, we were all left open mouthed. But tell us about Oliver Zaug and signing Oliver Zaug. I don't know if you were still at the team.
No, he did. I was at the lake, but on the other shore from Lecco, where I had a house for a while. I think it was the only pro win of Oliver Zaug.
I was second.
Yeah. It was sort of like when we founded the team, we kind of like picked a rider each. We took turns, Kim Anderson and I. And he came up as one of those sort of stable guys who would be a good helper and quite sort of a quite loyal guy, but not a spectacular rider. And I was happy, even if I wasn't on the team anymore and hated the owner with a vengeance. I still was extremely happy to see Sal win. You know, I'm sorry to say that. And it was just a complete surprise, an absolute complete surprise that he was able to ride away. I think that final was also different in the sense there was a quite steep, quite narrow climb up to, I think it was a small chapel. And I remember watching it at home from the other shore of the lake, thinking that I'm pretty close, but also really far away. And it was sort of with mixed feelings because that team then eventually had already changed with the arrival of Johan Brunel, and I had no interest in being in part of that, obviously. So yeah, bittersweet, I suppose. Bit same as Dan Martin probably feels about the race.
I used to love that finish, actually. That was a really cool finish with the little climb and then the race along the lake that, as you say, it was a mix between the Como finish and the Bergamo finish, whereby you had a climb to attack on, but then it was this cat and mouse game towards the line.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport. Fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science in Sport for supporting the Cycling Podcast. This is Lionel again. I'm back from my ride in Scotland, and I think I can report that I'm about 33.3% beta fuel after getting myself around the six stages of the Tour de Corse. I'm also probably 33.3% haggis and 33.3% lawn sausage after the, well, I didn't have a full Scottish breakfast every morning, but probably four mornings out of six I did. Very enjoyable they were too, but it was the beta fuel that really kept me topped up over the course of the week as we ticked off the kilometres on our ride from Bonnyrigg to Dingwall. The whole series will be out for Explore a bit later on this year. In the meantime, you know the message. You can get 25% off everything at scienceinsport.com with the discount code SISCP25.
Well, chaps, in the concluding part of today's podcast, we'll continue to talk about the Giro di Lombardia in Lombardia. Dan, we've talked about your victory in 2014. You had some other near misses. You had some heartache in Lombardia as well. But last year, just 12 months ago, it was also the last race of your career. I mean, was that just a sort of convenient, serendipitous opportunity because it was the last race of the season and you had decided you'd had enough? Or were you quite adamant that you wanted to finish at a race in a place that meant a lot to you?
I think it's quite poetic, actually, that it finished, especially that the last year's edition finished in Bergamo. Obviously, I won in 2014, so it was a beautiful way to finish. I I had friends at the finish line, and it was yeah, just although the day didn't really go to plan. How I obviously would have been nice to go out on a real big high, but at the same time, I was realistic of my chances going in, and it was the hardest course I've ever ridden, I think, apart from 2016. So probably the second hardest course, and yeah, it was just a brutal day's racing. I think it was, and it really did cement my decision that it was the right one. That mainly because I didn't have to follow any of these crazy guys down a slightly damp downhill anymore. Because it was just a brutal day's racing. It was really the pace was really high all day. Like, I think it was one of the highest average power outputs I've ever done in a one day race, and it just showed me that, yeah, you know what, this is I just had enough of suffering, and that's why, yeah, it was a good way, because if that race had gone completely how I wanted it to go, and I got on the podium or got a result at least, I maybe would have raised question marks as to whether I was making the right decision. But the fact that I completely got my ass kicked, it was yeah, and I just spent the whole day suffering and just wishing it was over. Even though I still managed to, I was finishing the second group still, so I wasn't miles behind. I think if I had just bothered to sprint from the group I was in, I probably would have got top 20, you know. So it was not a disastrous of a day, but, and it still showed that I had a decent level, but it just showed me that I was just over suffering.
Dan, were you suffering because you had also lost some of the desire to suffer in training, or were you suffering because there had been a physical deterioration that you'd noticed over a period of months and maybe a couple of years?
No, I think I was really enjoying training still, to be honest. I was really enjoying going out and the structure of that and the challenge of, and challenging myself in training. It was just the, yeah, I mean, mate, I don't know why. I think it was just a case of, yeah, I just needed a change. I think it's a long time, and every year, that's also why I needed to take I took a decent off-season break every year, because at the end of the season, I do think that physically you don't potentially need the rest. It's more a mental break from suffering, from pushing yourself day in, day out, and from hurting yourself. And that mental refresh at the end of the year really recharges the batteries. And because every season towards the October time, you do start to think, oh, I've had enough of pushing myself now. And over 15 years of doing that, it just got to a point whereby it was just enough. You know, I just had enough. And it was, I think racing's also changed. I think it was very much Lombardia used to be the break would go quite easily at the start, or some years it would take 40 kilometers, but then you kind of ride along talking and chatting, and it would be a very typical, I guess we'd call it typical Italian way of racing, the slow build-up to a grand finale, whereas now the racing is just all in all day, and it's just such hard racing. And that was partly due last year because we did have that little bit of a chat, but then because it was such a strong breakaway, once the chasing started, it was full on all day. And it was, yeah, it just, the whole level of the sport has just risen up. And it's, although it was still possible for me to be competitive, it just wasn't, it was getting harder and harder to, you just have to, everybody else is willing to push the limits and go on these long training camps. Even, I mean, Jonas Vingegaard, the Tour de France winner, has just been on a 3-week training camp to prepare for these races. That 10 years ago, that would never have happened, you know. So it's the Vuelta was the training camp of Lombardia, effectively, and you'd openly see guys saying that. So it's it just shows the level of professionalism in the sport now has just gone so high that everybody on the start line is ready to go. Whereas 10 years ago, it would have been a handful of, like, there would have been 10 names who were really motivated, and half the field just were thinking their holidays already.
Dan, it's going to be the last hurrah, the last race for a couple of illustrious riders at the weekend. Vincenzo Nibali and Alejandro Valverde are both riding their last race at Lombardia on Saturday. Just talk to us a little bit about your relationship with those two, both riders with whom you locked horns really on a regular basis. Similar riders to you in some respects, certainly Valverde.
Yeah, definitely. Alejandro, obviously, I've known, raced against him for a long time, and we had a very similar race program for many, many years, even starting racing in races like Tour of Med in 2008, 2009, in the same races, Valencia. I quite often shared a Spanish race program with him. He often going up against each other, obviously not only the classics but Catalunya and then Dauphiné, Tour de France, Vuelta, whereas Vincenzo obviously used to go more against the Giro. And so I know Alejandro a lot more than Nibali, but yeah, it's almost like a massive change in the guard this year. Obviously these are two legends of the sport. They're Grand Tour winners, they're classics winners, and then yeah, they're going to be, they're characters of the sport. And it's, yeah, it's going to be strange, I think, for a lot of fans, because that's something that we can see, well, I think, is changing slightly in the sport. And potentially this is a whole new podcast discussion we're going to start here, but the longevity of careers is questionable now, in my opinion. And are we going to see somebody like Alejandro or in Vincenzo again that are sustainably in the front of the echelons of the sport for 15 years? Nearly 20 years in Alejandro's case, you know, and I don't see the current crop of riders being able to sustain their careers for that long.
I remember talking to Shane Bannon, my old boss at Green Edge, about this, and he said a lot changed after it became, I mean, you would even say almost a trend, but not potentially imperative, that you did such long stretches of altitude training. You know, when you think of the ways Bradley Wiggins prepared for his one tour win, or how Chris Froome prepared for his tour wins, that how much actually goes into riding that way and preparing yourself that way. He thought that it was going to mean that a lot of riders' career would be shorter, because the potential of burning out, either physically or mentally, is a lot more prevalent in this modern way of preparing yourself. Do you see any likelihood in that?
Yeah, definitely. I think that's what, the last 2 years of my career, I definitely went all in, as far as, I didn't do the training camps, but the level of training and professionalism that I really stepped up, and my numbers got better as well. That's why I was able to stay competitive. But I think it's also the fans that will suffer, because you don't get this long-term relationship with the characters within the sport. If there's a new guy, I mean, just look at the Tour de France the last few years, other than Tadej Pogacar winning 2 years in a row, it's almost like there's different contenders every year. You don't get that consistent top five, top 10 riders. That there was a few years, probably like, if you say from 2012, 2013 until 2018, 2019, where the five or six of the top 10 of the Tour de France was regularly the same guys, or there was the same favorites list year after year. And I think that's where, as cycling fans, you kind of you build a relationship, you build this fandom whereby people get their favorite riders. But if those favorite riders are changing every year, or the guys winning are changing every year, it gets a little bit more difficult to relate to.
No, I also think, I mean, there's a lot of things go into the reality of modern cycling. But one thing that's also now compared to 10 years ago, there's a lot more money in cycling now than there used to be, I think. And at the top end, exactly. Yeah. So you don't need a 10-year career to set yourself up for life. If you're one of the 10, 15 best riders in the peloton, you'd probably be pretty well off after a handful of years in terms of the financial perspective. I'm not saying that that'll force riders to race less if they really want to be bike riders, but I think it has something to say in the longevity of career, and also the possibility to be competitive for such a long time. A
couple of races before Lombardy at the weekend, Trevalli, Varesine, which will give some clues, I think, on Wednesday, and Pogacar was riding there, and Gran Piemonte, which will tell us nothing about Lombardy because it's pretty flat, and then the races in the Veneto the week after Lombardy. Also at the weekend, Filippo Ganna is taking on the hour record in Grenken. Believe it or not, I'm going to be there in an indoor cycling stadium somewhere where I would never usually tread. 55.548 kilometers, Dan Bigham's record. That's what Ganna's got to be. I think most people think he's going to beat it. Some people think he's even going to get to 60 kilometers. I think that's pretty far-fetched. But that concludes the entertainment for today. I'm going to thank you, Dan Martin, and we'll wish you a very happy rest of your holiday in Tenerife, low altitude training camp. And I'm going to thank you, Brian Nygaard. What do we call you at the start of the podcast? Dracula, the cycling Dracula?
The accidental cycling tourist. I'll be heading up to my old hometown in close to Como for the weekend. So yeah, maybe I can bring back some better sound bites this time.
I should also say that we've got an episode of the cycling podcast Femina coming out this week that will drop any day, and in that you'll get a full review of the World Championships in Wollongong from a women's point of view, or from the point of view of the women's races. Of course, we covered the men's races last week in the podcast. And we'll be back next week. I should also say very warm congratulations, resounding congratulations to Lionel Burney, who, well, as you've heard in this episode, completed his Tour d'Écosse last week, his Tour of Scotland. And, well, we'll be hearing from Lionel in the regular podcast very soon. Thank you, chaps.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.